Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. I'm your host, Nicholas Rapold. This week, I'm speaking with the director of the Ukraine documentary, 20 Days in Mariupol. Mstislav Chernov was a video journalist for the Associated Press who stayed in the city of Mariupol when the Russian invasion of Ukraine began in February 2022. The AP journalists were the last from an international organization who remained in the city, and they were able to film the people and the streets during the Russian siege and the brutal bombardment, at one point filming from a hospital that became a target. Chernov and his colleagues won a Pulitzer Prize for their reporting during the siege, but Chernov's documentary goes beyond their news clips to give a full, tense chronicle of these days. I asked him about crafting his documentary, getting the truth out about the war, and what films, fiction and documentary, have inspired him. 20 Days in Mariupol is in theaters now. I wonder if we could start at the beginning for this documentary. When did you decide to make a documentary feature? Because obviously you're shooting throughout, but did you know while you were shooting that later on you would assemble it, or did that come in partway through the process?
So I've been a conflict reporter for 9 years already, since the invasion actually started in Ukraine in 2014. I started shooting for AP as a videographer, and then I went to different countries, different conflicts like Iraq and Afghanistan and Karabakh and Libya, Syria. And I was shooting for news. I'm basically a news cameraman. But I have to admit that being constrained with this 2 minute, 3 minute, 4 minute maximum videos was always not enough for me. Especially because when you speak about conflicts, when you report on such a emotional and such complex issues, it's just not enough. There are so many questions to be asked. There are so many stories to be told in depth, and especially in Ukraine, because it's my home country. So for a long time, I wanted to do something more substantial than just shooting news. And when we found ourselves in Mariupol, the city was already besieged. I have sent about 4 or 5 news dispatches. I have realized that there are actually no other journalists that are sending videos and photos from the city. That was phenomenal for the city of 400,000 people not to have a single journalist. It's just unheard of. Later, we found out that there was Montes Pilarovicius. He was shooting as well, but he was unfortunately executed in the one of the checkpoints as he was leaving the city. So I realized that every single minute I shoot is important. Yeah. I realized that I should just stop shooting news and shoot everything. Again, it wasn't at that point, it wasn't the idea to be a film, but I just realized I can't miss anything. And I kept shooting as much as I could because no electricity, very few hard drives and cards. So I had to be very economic. It was very tough. It was harder to maintain equipment to keep working than to actually find food and water. That's a bigger challenge. Although we ate for like one time a day.
Wow. Yeah.
I had to melt our water from snow, but the production was harder. So when we left on 15th of March, when we broke out with this, I had about 30 hours of footage in total. And by miracle, we were able to take all of this through 15 Russian checkpoints that were checking our car, asking questions. So we were just very lucky. It was the first day, a very chaotic day when many people were leaving. The green corridor was just open. So we were very lucky that we got through. And by that time, I probably would send only 30 to 40 minutes with this terrible connection we had in Mariupol. So I had so much more. Mm-hmm. And AP has a partnership with the frontline. So I almost immediately started thinking about making a film because, yeah, how else could you tell the scale and an amount of suffering that we saw?
Yeah, I came to appreciate how good you and your team were at really getting to the heart of the matter in certain scenes. I know that sometimes this can be portrayed as kind of sensationalistic, but I also think you have a way of being very direct about the emotion of a scene. So I'm curious, What can the feature show that the shorter clips can't?
There are two layers to this. One is an immediate layer. Actually, there are more than two layers, fewer layers. The first one is an immediate layer because in a news, you're constrained to certain timing. And just having a chance, having a possibility to give a viewer to stay longer with people who they see, to give some space to breathe and process what they've just seen, that gives an immense depth to those emotions that we experience through the screen. These moments of silence, they're incredible. Important, as important as moments of hard emotions. And that is where the longer form is better, because in the news, we just don't have this silence. There is always something going on.
Right.
There's either commentary or just the news are rushed, which is okay, which is understandable. It's just a different medium. So the second layer is, and it's an important layer in a film, is the layer of a misinformation. Now, we live in an age when countries fight not for which images are shown or not shown, but how the images are interpreted. The phenomenal thing is that the footage of, for example, a bombing of a maternity hospital, which was attacked by Russian propaganda, was shown on the Russian TV channels as much as it was shown on any other TV channel across the world. It was just a different commentary. It was a different interpretation. So obviously, I don't have a mission to fight that. I have no power or authority to do that. But I think just giving the viewer enough context of what happened before the scene, how the scene unfolded, what happened afterwards, mm-hmm. is already working in the favor of truth coming through the images. It just helps the viewer to interpret the event they see on the screen in the way it really was unfolding.
Yeah.
The more time we have to share with the viewer, there is less space for manipulation, if you summarize.
Yeah,
and a third level to that is a historical level. If we think about how we perceive the world around us, we do perceive it through the news and headlines. But if we look back, to what we know about the Holocaust, if we look back to what we know about Vietnam War, many other historical events, we form our understanding of the past through films and books, so longer forms. I don't go and read news and headlines of what happened during the Second World War. I read books and I watch films. So as for Ukrainians, historically is important, but also for just general public, having a film about an event is very important.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm wondering, as a filmmaker putting it together, how do you structure the film? How do you pace the film? How do you develop the chronology of it so that a viewer isn't overwhelmed? There's a balance for me where I kind of want to be overwhelmed because I want to absorb the fullness of the experience as much as I can as a total outsider. But you must be aware of when a person is just overloaded and shuts down. So really on a filmmaking level, how did you approach that?
No, that is something that was discussed a lot. That is one of the main challenges probably of this film when it was put together with Michelle Meissner, the amazing frontline editor who was helping me through this process. So yeah, I think the first thing, what we had to decide, what is that exactly we're trying to do? So even a decision of how far we want to go and how far we want to bring an audience along with us was a first step to that. And then a very important editorial decision that we should absolutely not sanitize anything that is happening on the screen, because, well, that is an opposite of a theme of the film. That is an opposite of what is a film about. The violence and the destruction and the suffering that the viewer sees on the screen, it's a vital part of the film. It's not an effect to impress the viewer. And therefore, we just needed to find a right balance between not, as I said, sanitizing, but also not pushing the viewer away by overwhelming. And the third thing is that we have to always think about respect towards the victims. We have to be sure that we treat the images of those people who unfortunately lost their lives with dignity, with respect. So that is also an element which led to very, very precise editing in the editing room. Like every single centimeter of a crop on the screen was considered, every single blur was considered, every single second of how much you can show of the in the surgery room, for example, was thought through. And there are so many images, so much more images that I wanted to show, I felt that I needed to show, but I just held back because we didn't want to completely overwhelm the viewer. But it worked because we were really worried before the Sundance that it would be too much for the viewers. But in fact, the film got the audience awards, and it was surprising and eye-opening for us that the audience actually thought that that's what exactly what they needed to see.
No, definitely. I mean, I noticed that too. It wasn't, that's what it was. It was the audience award. And part of the documentary, its narrative, if you can say that, besides the progress of the war, is just your progress as a living person there, figuring out how long you can stay there and continue to do this mission almost. When did you feel like your life was really, you know, in danger? And I mean, was there some specific thing?
Yeah, I think we realized that our lives are really in danger when Russian authorities have started to claim that we are information terrorists. The city was already besieged, and we knew that we are the only ones with a camera there. So it was pretty clear what would happen to us if we are caught. So already at that point, it was quite clear. And we were getting a lot of threats in the social media whenever we had little access to them. And then it just got worse and worse. You know, the front line moved in the city. At some point, we got surrounded by Russian forces, and by a miracle, well, spoilers alert, by a miracle, we were saved. So yeah, that moment was really scary.
Yeah, being an explicit target.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that is something which we never expected that will happen, because usually journalism, it's not anonymous, but at least like it's a shared responsibility. And at this point, we were just alone. And again, an example of what happened to Mantas, a terrible, terrible event. He was just executed on the checkpoint when he was caught because he had camera and the passport.
Yeah, makes it very, very, very real. And it is helpful just for a viewer navigating it, having your voiceover. I wonder if you could talk about how you approach that, because I felt like there's great care taken with it, that it's very steady, but not a voice also that is too comforting or is too distant.
The voiceover, the idea of this voiceover came with the idea of a structure of the film. Initially, the film was not structured as a first-hand account of the events. I've recorded a series of interviews with the survivors of the film, but at some point in the editing room, we realized that it is probably more effective to keep the audience and to keep the narration within these 20 days. That would bring a viewer more in the story and give it more urgency. Therefore, we had to search for another narrative device which will keep the narrative within these 20 days. And eventually, I did some voiceovers, and I'm not a professional, well, actor or narrator in any way. This is the first time I do this. And it took us a long time to find the right tone for it to be not too emotional, because I wouldn't really want to impose any emotions on the audience, but at the same time, not too distant and cold, because I am actually part of this community I'm telling the story of. So I am emotional. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I cannot hide that. So yeah, that was the search for the right tone, even the right volume of the narration was hard.
Yeah.
But we eventually, we found it.
I mean, I also found it interesting. The police officer who is helping you for most of the movie, he's present in the movie, but you don't really turn him into a character, which I think, you know, another documentary might do. And that, I think you also do that with other people in the film, where you get a sense of someone maybe. So what's behind that decision with the police officer? I mean, in that case, I wonder if it's just a matter of security for a part of it.
No, it was partially, again, it was partially the narrative structure decision. As I said, we recorded a lot of interviews with doctors who you see in a film, with Vladimir who you see in a film. So if you would put all this together, these characters would be much more developed and they would have more screen time. But the way the story is told, the way everything is connected, I felt that it's enough space. I just wanted to give an audience a variety of voices, but still to be invested in every single story told on the screen. So again, there was a lot of back and forth search of how much of this particular person or that particular person would be on the screen.
Yeah. And just to kind of pull back for maybe a, if this is the right word, the kind of moral viewpoint that I think is, it's unavoidable in the sense that these are civilian casualties. It's a hospital that you're barricaded in or seeking shelter in. When I try to think through why this is happening as a war, the way it is happening, and I think of the rationale that's given for why, I don't know, let's say the United States or some other country doesn't become more actively involved in pushing back, I just come to the fact that it feels like there's a calculation being made, which is that the war after that would be worse than the war now, so we're going to let this war play out. So what are your thoughts on that, the realpolitik aspect of it? The movie, I think, is saying, you know, these are actual lives.
I think the main concept here and the reason why it is focused so much, the film is focused so much on the civilians, is exactly this. We would have a choice to maybe cover more of the soldiers fighting or more of action, but it is a choice to, and I still feel it's the most important aspect of this, specifically this war, well, every war, but again, we speak about this war. So this, the civilians losing their lives and losing their children and not even having an answer to a very simple question, why this is happening to them,
yeah,
is being a central thought of a film. So, as you said, this film does ask the main question, at least the main question for me, of this war. Why is this happening? The why is a central question. Marina Yatskova, who loses her son Kirill, asks this question. And that is something that was always with me throughout this year of editing. Mm. So, that's what all the war is about. What do we do? What can we do, and what people who witness this horror can do, mm-hmm, about what they see, and could they stop it? Could I somehow stop it as a film director or a journalist? Could people who are in power do something about it? So all I can do is just to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And it is quite upsetting because we all would like to do more than just to ask questions. But if this question reaches the right eyes, I think it will make a huge difference.
Yeah. Again, just thinking as a journalist and as a filmmaker, what are some films, whether fiction or documentary, that you feel have depicted either a similar situation or war generally or the experience of war for people in an effective and true way?
I can tell you what inspires me in my work, not only the work I've done with this film, but in general, the work I do in conflicts. And the word inspire is probably a bit wrong, but that's what I always reference. So from scripted films perspective, I would say that the work of Emmanuel Lubezki in such films as Children of Men inspired me a lot in my camera work as well. All the films of Paul Greengrass as well. We talk about, not about storytelling, but more of a camera work, camera movement and scenes, assembly, and so on and so forth. In a documentary, it goes a bit deeper. I have probably seen all of available films and reports on the siege of Sarajevo before starting working on this film. It was so that siege was a reference to me. And I was shocked how many similar visuals there were. But on the creative side, probably a camera person, Sans Soleil, and the already classic war films like Restrepo. And we referenced a lot a frontline film for Samat, came out several years ago that the frontline, PBS frontline was also working with, and I personally know the filmmaker, and I really respect her work. Those are the main references, you would say.
Yeah, I think that probably brings us to the end of the conversation. I am just curious, just quickly, do you think you will return to the same type of journalistic camera work and video making? Or
good question. I'm really trying not to. However, I just can't shoot in the way I shot before anymore. I always, let's say, I at least overshoot everything right now. And I do ask a bit different questions. I follow up more and spend more time with people I see and I meet and film. So yeah, I would probably never come back to normal news gathering, news making. That being said, I think any news report could benefit from a deeper view and a different kind of a more documentary approach to it. So that doesn't hurt. That only helps.
All right, we'll wrap up there. Mstislav, thank you so much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.